They called her a ghost, a cleaner for the powerful, a killer who never asked questions until they ordered her to murder a child. In the shadows of Miami's elite, among offshore accounts, charity scams, and sealed courtrooms, one woman said no. Now she's being hunted by the same men she once protected. No Child's Blood is the gripping, emotionally raw, first-person confession of a female assassin-turned-whistleblower. A woman who risked everything to protect one boy and expose the financial corruption hiding behind bureaucracy and red tape. These aren't just murder tales. These are the secrets they kill to keep buried. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. The first time I entered Carver's estate, I thought it was going to be just like any other high society job. They didn't even want me to use my real name. Just a number. A face in a crowd of hired guns and shady politicians. In the world I work, that's how it goes. The higher the power, the more you become invisible, like a shadow. But this wasn't supposed to happen. I stood in the grand foyer of Carver's estate, my eyes scanning the pristine marble floors, the towering white columns, and the massive chandelier above. All of it gleaming in the soft glow of a dozen crystal lights. It was all so clean, so perfect. Just the way they liked it. They being the ones who paid for secrets to stay hidden. The cartel, drug dealers, the kind of people you only meet through dark backdoor deals. I adjusted my black dress, swallowing down the nerves gnawing at my insides. The job was simple, a lot like the others. Find the target, neutralize them, and disappear into the shadows. But tonight, as I walked toward the private office, something in the air was different. A heaviness I couldn't quite place. It felt like I was about to cross a line I hadn't signed up for. Valeria, a deep voice called out from the shadows. I turned, but only slightly, enough to see a tall man wearing a tailored suit. His face was clean-shaven, his expression unreadable. A ghost among the living, like the rest of them. He was the kind of man who never looked nervous. But I could feel the weight in his gaze. "Come in," he said, motioning toward the office. "They're waiting." I followed him inside, trying to ignore the buzz of unease creeping along my spine. Inside the office, three men stood by a long glass table, discussing something that sounded important. They stopped when I entered. The man leading the room, a stocky figure in his early 40s, extended his hand to me. "You're the one they've called to clean up our little problem?" I took his hand, my grip firm but cold. "That's what I do." My voice was calm, but my mind was already spinning, running through the usual steps. Assessment, calculation, cold precision. They slid a thick manila folder across the table to me, and I opened it slowly. Inside was a picture, a child. No older than 10, with dark eyes and soft curls. I frowned, blinking at the photograph. There was a name printed below the image. I didn't speak at first. My gaze stayed on the child's face, wondering if I was seeing things right. The man in the suit cleared his throat. "That's the target." The room fell quiet. I looked up, meeting his eyes for the first time. "You want me to kill a child?" The words felt foreign, even to me. I'd killed before. Hundreds of times, each one easier than the last. But a child? That wasn't part of the script. The man's expression didn't change. "You kill what we pay for. That's the deal, Valeria." I leaned back, pushing the folder aside. The weight of the situation hit me hard. The shadows of justice here were darker than I'd realized. This wasn't just about money anymore. It was about something far more dangerous. Something that made me question everything. "I can't do it," I said, my voice colder than I felt. "I'm not going to kill a kid." There was a pause, and then the room shifted. The man in the suit didn't flinch. He didn't raise his voice. But his words cut deep, like a knife I hadn't seen coming. "If you walk away, Valeria, you'll be dead before the sun rises." My heart skipped a beat. He wasn't bluffing. I stood up, pushing the chair back, my mind racing. A mix of anger and confusion flooded my chest. "I'm done with this." I turned to leave, but the sound of a phone ringing stopped me in my tracks. It wasn't one of theirs, it was mine. I fumbled for the phone in my bag. No one ever called me on this line unless something had gone horribly wrong. I answered, my hand trembling. "Cruz." "Valeria," a voice whispered, barely audible through the line. "You made a mistake." I froze. I knew the voice. It was the same voice that had contacted me years ago for my first job, a shadowed figure, always cloaked in secrecy. "You can't walk away from this one," the voice continued. "Not if you value your life." The line went dead. I dropped the phone in shock. I turned back to the men in the room, all of them watching me with cold, calculating eyes. They knew I was trapped. And that was the moment I knew. I had just stepped into something I couldn't escape. Not if I wanted to live. The moment I stepped out of Carver's estate, I knew I wasn't leaving with clean hands or a clean slate. The night air in Coral Gables felt colder than usual, but that wasn't the Miami breeze. That was the chill of being marked. I didn't drive my usual route back to Wynwood. I took a stolen car, a silver Nissan scratched and dusty, with one working headlight. My real car was already compromised. I knew how these things worked. Once you say no to power, you're not just a liability, you're the next job. They didn't care that I had served them for 10 years. They didn't care how many people I buried in the Everglades for them. I had broken the one rule that held it all together. Do the job. Now I was the job. By the time I got back to my studio, my instincts were already screaming. I parked two blocks away, used the back alley, and entered through a hidden door behind the dumpster. No lights. I moved with silence I'd trained into my bones. Inside the piano studio, everything looked untouched. But that's what worried me. It was too untouched. No signs of entry, no disturbed papers, no trace of surveillance. Except for one thing. My secondary phone, the burner with biometric lock, the one I kept hidden inside an old piano casing, was gone. They'd been here. And they'd only taken that. I kept the room dark as I opened the hidden panel under the floor. My ledgers were still there, the carefully curated files that could unravel every senator, narco, and private equity shark who had ever used me to erase a problem. Shadows of justice, indeed. Their version of justice was clean suits, televised speeches, and contracts soaked in invisible blood. I was the hidden killer that let them smile on camera. But now I had to burn the mask and become something else. The first attack came faster than I expected. I had just started wiping my trail, clearing offshore accounts, rerouting crypto, torching fake IDs, when I felt the wrong pressure on the front doorknob. I didn't move. I waited. The door cracked open slowly. A woman's voice called out softly, like a friend arriving late. "Delivery for Val." I moved before she finished the sentence. I tackled her in the hallway, disarmed her Glock with one swift motion, and drove her head into the corner of the doorframe. She was fast, trained, but not fast enough. We struggled across the floor. Her knife slashed the air near my ribs. I rolled and wrapped a cord from the piano pedals around her neck. "Who sent you?" I hissed. She gasped but didn't speak. The blood vessels in her eyes burst before her larynx gave out. I didn't feel bad. That's the thing about being hunted. Morality isn't part of the math. I dragged her body into the soundproof practice room, a space I once used to teach children scales and sonatas. Now it was a tomb. I opened her phone. The last message read, "Green light confirmed. She refused the child contract. Erase her tonight." There was no name, no timestamp, just an auto-deleting encryption key tied to a familiar VPN, one used by the city comptroller's office. The people trying to kill me weren't just gangsters. They were the ones who passed laws. I burned her body with bleach and accelerants. No DNA, no fingerprints. Just fire and silence. But before I torched the phone, I saw one more thing. A GPS pin. A location. A condo in Brickell. Registered to a shell company called Southwind Futures. The same shell I'd traced years ago while investigating a financial scam involving public housing funds and fake youth programs. That's when it hit me. The boy they wanted dead wasn't just some unfortunate witness. He was the son of a man who once leaked documents on Southwind Futures, a former city treasurer turned whistleblower. The man was found suicided in his car 2 years ago. Now they wanted to finish the job. Kill the boy. Seal the legacy. Tie the noose. Bureaucracy, red tape, and hidden killers, all working together. I needed leverage. I returned to my secret server in Little Haiti, a storage locker wired with a custom VPN and off-grid power. There, I uploaded part of my piano ledger, the one labeled Carver, wealth shielding operations. Names, bank transfers, disguised real estate trusts, offshore accounts, donor lists masking as youth rehabilitation sponsors. I didn't leak everything, just enough to rattle the cage. I sent it to an encrypted inbox used by a Venezuelan investigative reporter named Tomas Delgado. We'd never met, but I knew he loved crime narratives and chilling accounts. If he published even a piece of it, it would create noise. I needed that noise, because once they realized I hadn't run, that I was staying, fighting, breathing, they would panic. and panic makes them sloppy. I was almost back at the studio when I saw the black envelope tucked into my gate. No stamp. No return address. Inside, a single thing. A human finger. Severed. Still wet. I knew who it belonged to. Gallo. My only friend in this business. The one who taught me how to hack surveillance loops and disappear in South Beach without leaving a scent. He was dead. And beneath the finger was a folded note. Finish the job, Valeria. Or the boy bleeds next. I sat in my car for a long time that night, holding the note, blood soaking through my gloves. They thought this would break me. They forgot who made me. They forgot how many secrets I buried. Now I'm unburying them all. I'd heard a man scream before. I'd caused it, more times than I care to count. But there was something different about the way this one screamed. Not the sound itself, it was the shape of it. The way it bounced off the concrete walls of my studio basement, curled into the corners, and came back smaller, more broken. His name was Mateo Ruiz, a mid-tier courier for the Saldivar cartel. Ran money drops from Broward to Hialeah. Smart enough to stay useful. Not smart enough to stay out of my path. I'd pulled him from a nightclub bathroom 2 nights after Gallo's finger showed up in my mailbox. I didn't kill him right away. That was the old me. The silent gunshot. The clean getaway. Now I needed investigative tales. I needed unraveling stories. And that meant blood, pressure, and truth. He was tied to an upright piano frame I'd stripped down years ago. His hands were zip-tied to the cast-iron strings. His legs duct-taped to the pedals. Every time he squirmed, the old metal shrieked. He looked up at me through swollen eyes, blood crusted at his lip. "You used to be clean," he muttered. "A ghost." I leaned in. "That ghost is dead. You killed her." His head slumped. "You think you're gonna survive this?" "I don't need to survive," I said. "I just need answers." I started with the names I already knew. Carver, the estate, Southwind Futures. Mateo denied everything, even as I twisted piano wire tighter into his wrists. But when I pulled out a photo of the boy, the one they wanted dead, he went still. "You recognize him," I said. "No," he whispered. "Wrong answer." I grabbed a tuning hammer, the kind used to adjust string tension. I pressed it to his pinky joint and turned slowly. The popping sound was small. His scream was not. "Try again," I said. He coughed, spat blood. "He's not the target," he hissed. "He's the key." I froze. "The key to what?" Mateo looked up, eyes wild. "To everything. To why Carver's still breathing. To why nobody touches the foundation accounts. His dad had files. Real ones. Names, numbers, wealth shielding charts." That phrase hit me like a gut punch. Files. Charts. If the boy had them. No. If the boy was the only one who knew what they were, then killing him wasn't a hit. It was insurance. I stepped back. My hand trembled just slightly. "You knew," I said. "And you tried to help kill him anyway." Mateo grinned, broken teeth flashing. "We don't ask questions. Neither did you until now." He wasn't wrong. I hadn't cared about true stories. I wasn't in the business of moral lines. Until the target had dimples and a history they wanted erased. I could have ended it right there. One bullet. Instead, I walked to the workbench and opened the old briefcase where I kept the piano ledger. The pages were brittle, water-stained. But they told stories. Chilling secrets. Southern secrets. Crime narratives written in financial codes and hush money receipts. I flipped to the page labeled Project Kestrel. It was a youth foundation in Liberty City, supposed to help orphan children transition out of foster care. Turns out, it was a shell, laundering drug money and trafficking bribes through educational grants. And guess whose father used to work there? The boys. That's why they needed him gone. That's why they hired me. I turned back to Mateo, whose breathing had slowed. "You're not walking out of here," I said. "Neither are you," he croaked. "I already know," I said, lifting the silencer. But before I could pull the trigger, he coughed something under his breath. "The boy, he's with the pastor. On NW 13th. New Mercy Revival. It's not safe." My heart dropped. A pastor? They were hiding him in a church. The moment the bullet entered Mateo's skull, it felt like the only merciful act I had left. I wrapped his body in plastic, tossed it in the walk-in freezer below the studio, and wiped the room down until every chilling detail was clean. Then I grabbed my Glock, the burner phone, and the folder, and left. I drove through Miami like a ghost, headlights off half the way. The city buzzed around me, unaware that a woman with blood on her hands and fire in her gut was about to walk into a holy place to protect a child she hadn't even met. As I pulled up to New Mercy Revival, something in my chest cracked. I hadn't believed in God since I was 14. But that night, I prayed the boy was still alive. The front of New Mercy Revival looked like every old church I'd ever walked past in Miami. Faded white walls, sun-warped wood panels, and a sign with chipped gold lettering that read, "Come as you are." I didn't come as I was. I came armed. Two Glock 19s, a ceramic blade strapped to my thigh, and a flash drive tucked inside my bra. No prayers. No mercy. Just intent. I rang the bell and waited. It was nearly 2 a.m. The streets were quiet, the kind of quiet that means somebody's watching. Then the door creaked open. He was tall, dark-skinned, in his 60s. His voice was slow, southern cautious. "You the one they said was coming?" "I'm the one who's not here to kill him," I said. He stepped aside. I slipped inside, heart still pounding. The boy was asleep on a cot in the back office, curled under a blanket with faded cartoon prints. His hair was longer than the photo. He had a small scar above his brow, and a stuffed toy beside him, a rabbit with one ear chewed off. He looked so small, so human. And yet every financial crime, every murder tale, every carefully curated lie they tried to cover up was buried inside this child's memory. I stood there for a long time, staring at him. The pastor came beside me. "You're the one who used to make people disappear," he said. I didn't answer. He pointed to the folder clutched in my hand. "That ledger," he said softly. "That's the real reason they want you both dead, isn't it?" I laid the folder on his office table. Opened it. Inside, handwritten ledgers, offshore transfer printouts, and post-it notes in a language of coded finance and blood. I'd spent years building it. I used to call it my piano book, hidden inside the piano studio walls under Bach and Chopin. Every page told chilling narratives no newspaper would print. Unsettling stories about bureaucracy dressed as charity. Justice tales rewritten by lobbyists and money launderers. And in the middle of it all, a page labeled Luciano Navarro, the boy's father. He was the whistleblower. He'd discovered that Carver and three sitting politicians had funneled $2.3 million through a youth charity that only existed on paper. The shelter was actually an empty duplex used for asset shielding. Luciano had created a digital breadcrumb trail. But before he could go public, he died in a staged overdose. What no one knew, not even Carver, was that he gave the encryption key to someone else. His son, the child I was sent to kill. I stared at the pastor. "Does he know what he's carrying?" "No," he said. "But he has dreams. Says he sees numbers. Memorized passwords that don't make sense." My stomach dropped. Luciano hadn't just given his son the key. He'd trained his mind to be the key. The boy was the ledger. I knew then, if I didn't move fast, they'd take the pastor next. I asked for a computer, anything I could use to digitize what I had left. In the back room, I began uploading sections of the piano ledger to my old journalist contact, Tomas Delgado. He was still live, still breathing, still chasing crime stories in Latin America. I sent him pieces, account statements, donor chains, ties between Miami's courts and narco-funded re-election campaigns. I added a warning. "If this file goes dark, I'm dead. And so is the kid. Publish on drop. No red tape. No edits." As dawn crept through the stained glass windows, I returned to the boy's side. He was awake now, blinking at me. "You're the one," he whispered. "The lady with the guns." I froze. "What?" "You were in my dad's photos." He reached under the pillow, pulled out a faded Polaroid. It was me, younger, harder-eyed, standing beside Luciano outside a courthouse years ago. "I remember," he said. "My dad told me you were a protector." I couldn't speak. All I could do was nod and say, "I still am." But the moment was shattered by the sound of glass breaking. Gunshots. Three. Then four. The pastor's scream echoed down the hallway. I grabbed the boy, threw open the rear door, and bolted into the alley as bullets shattered the cross on the back wall. We ran through puddles and garbage and the roar of rising engines. The boy was sobbing. I didn't stop. I couldn't. We disappeared into the city before the sun fully rose. But we weren't safe. The pastor was dead. They'd found us. And now they knew the boy was awake, and that I was uploading chilling secrets to the world. They would come harder now. No more mercenaries. Now it would be Carver's estate itself. The syndicate. The men in suits with blood under their nails. I held the boy tighter as the bus carried us into the anonymous gray of North Miami motels. I whispered to him, "You're not just a child anymore." He looked up, wide-eyed. "You're the bomb they couldn't defuse," I said. "And now we both explode." I didn't sleep that night. Neither did he. The boy sat cross-legged on the motel bed, the sheets crumpled, the ASC groaning from the wall. He stared at me like I was some combination of guardian angel and executioner. I sat in the corner, Glock in my lap, every sense stretched razor thin. The pastor was dead. Tomas had gone dark after the first file upload. The burner phone kept buzzing with silent pings, trackers, location queries, code I used to write for these people. Now they were using it against me. But none of that was louder than the one thought pounding in my head. Don't let them break you. Because that's what they wanted, not just to kill me. They wanted to shatter me, make me one of them again. But I wouldn't. Not over this kid. Not over Noah. That was his name. He finally told me. We spent 3 days hiding in a string of anonymous places. A cheap Airbnb with no Wi-Fi. A Haitian family's storage garage with a cot and a bucket. A bait shop on the outskirts of Homestead that doubled as a smuggler's depot. I paid with silver. Old favors. A whisper here. A favor there. The cartel had flooded the city with fake flyers of me, photoshopped, doctored. I was suddenly a child trafficker, a foreign assassin, a Colombian radical. They used the media, red tape, bureaucracy, political fear, every dirty tool they had. But it was the kid who kept me human. One night, I found him sitting on the bathroom floor, tracing patterns into the foggy tile. "You ever kill somebody?" he asked. I paused. "Yes." He nodded like he already knew. Then he looked up at me. "Did you ever kill a kid?" My throat tightened. "No. Why not?" I knelt down next to him. My voice broke without permission. "Because your life is the only thing I haven't ruined." He blinked. "My dad said you were dangerous." "He was right," I said. "Are you still dangerous?" "Only to bad people." He reached out and touched my scar, the one across my temple from a ricochet back in Caracas. "You're sad," he said. It wasn't a question. I didn't answer. We moved again, this time deeper into the city, not away from danger but toward it. I knew we couldn't run forever. Not with what Noah carried in his mind, the memorized numbers, the passphrase, the mental cipher of Southwind Futures, Carver's Estate, and every financial crime locked in the silent ledger of a traumatized child. So I did what they feared most. I prepared to go public. Back in Wynwood, the piano studio was ashes, burned down days ago. But my second drop spot remained untouched. A storage unit in Opa-locka, behind a shuttered dance school. Inside was the last drive. The one with everything. Financial scams. Offshore accounts. Shell donors. Surveillance files labeled retired targets. Gallo's name was there. So was mine. And so was Noah's. We found a hacker. Young, twitchy genius. Name was Lex. Lex didn't ask questions. Just names and upload speeds. I handed her the drive. "You sure you want this online?" she asked. "I want the truth online." She grinned. "Then say goodbye to your anonymity." I didn't flinch. Neither did Noah. We waited in a safe flat upstairs as Lex set up a time drop to leak every file to 3 international investigative outlets. Once it went live, there'd be no turning back. They'd know. They'd come. That night, I gave Noah a burner tablet and let him watch cartoons. He laughed for the first time. I sat beside him, the pistol within reach, but my heart slowly unraveling. This wasn't just protection. This was penance. Perfection in detailing. That's what Carver had once called me. I used to be his finest tool. His hidden killer. Now, I was the hammer breaking every piece of the machine. But peace never lasts long in Miami. At 3:17 a.m., the building shook. A car bomb. We hit the floor as the wall blew open. Smoke. Screams. Shrapnel. I shielded Noah with my body. Car alarms blared. Fire licked up the hallway. I grabbed him, heart thundering, and we sprinted into the alley barefoot. A man stepped out from the shadows. Gun raised. His voice was calm. "You should have killed the boy, Valeria." I raised mine. "You should have stayed in hell." 2 shots. Mine hit first. He dropped. Blood pooled in the moonlight. Noah looked up at me, tears on his cheeks. "Was he one of them?" "Yes." "Did you know him?" "No, I lied. He was my first partner. The one who taught me to make kills look like suicides. The man who vouched for me on my first Carver job. But now he was just another corpse in a story that refused to stop writing itself. We ran again. And as the city turned orange behind us, I whispered over and over in my head. "No child's blood. No child's blood. No child's blood." Because once that line was crossed, there was no going back. And I wasn't done fighting. Not yet. There's something sacred about pressing send on a file that can take down a nation. It was just a tap, One fingertip on a cracked tablet screen in a graffiti-covered hideout above a fish market in North Miami. But the moment I did it, I felt like the world tilted sideways. Lex's upload pulsed to life. Green lights blinked across multiple global networks. Firewalls collapsed. Timers activated. And just like that, the piano ledger stopped being mine. It belonged to the world now. Gripping tales. Chilling details. True crime stories unraveling in real time. Each page a blade aimed at the throats of Miami's power elite. Lex turned to me, a nervous energy buzzing behind her thick-rimmed glasses. It's done. It's everywhere. Ecuador. Brussels. Bogota. CNN's dark web team just pinged it. I closed my eyes, then opened them. Good, I said. Now we wait for hell. It didn't take long. By morning, for headlines had already leaked. Miami politician accused of ties to child bribery ring. Anonymous data drop exposes $200 million in offshore laundering. Charity for foster youth a front for gun trade? The piano ledger, inside the syndicate. They used my title, the one I scribbled on those folders in blood and ink. Tomas Delgado finally surfaced, through a voice-only call routed through Amsterdam. He sounded winded. I don't know what you gave them, Valeria, he said. But people are jumping from rooftops. Then I gave them the truth, I said. Tomas exhaled, shaky. You're not safe. No, I said. But now neither are they. That night they came harder. Three SUVs. Unmarked. Full tactical. They didn't knock. They launched a grenade through the side of the building. I grabbed Noah mid-sentence and threw us both through the kitchen window. We hit the pavement and rolled. I dragged him into an alley and fired six rounds into the dark. One scream. Two bodies. They weren't cartel this time. They were federal. The U.S. government was in on it. Or at least a part of it. Some dark corridor of federal contractors who'd been paid for decades to clean the syndicate's mess. And now I was the mess. This wasn't just about financial corruption anymore. This was about erasure. Of names. Of stories. Of inconvenient truths. We fled again, this time with no plan, no contacts, no allies. The city shut itself against us. The boy didn't cry. Not once. Instead, he stared straight ahead and whispered, "Do we win?" It broke me. Because I didn't know. We found temporary cover in a halfway house near the edge of Overtown. An old woman named Lula ran it, once a resistance nurse in El Salvador. She took one look at me and said, "You've got martyr eyes." "I'm not dying for this," I said. She handed me a blanket. "No, you're living through it. That's worse." I patched up the bullet graze on my leg. Noah slept. Lula made soup. And I broke into Carver's cloud. Lex gave me access before she disappeared. A vulnerability in Carver's private VPN. And there it was. Project Cleanse. A plan to purge all links between the boy and the syndicate, and to reframe the public narrative in real time. Create deepfakes. Frame me as a rogue narco. Paint Noah as a traffic decoy, not a whistleblower's son. It was brilliant. It was evil. And it was already in motion. I recorded a video. No filters. No edits. Just me, bloodstained, tired, eyes wide open. I said his name. I said their names. I named judges, CEOs, foundation chairs. I read out transaction IDs. I described the crime scene investigations they'd buried. I told them about Gallo. About the pastor. About Luciano Navarro. I told them about Noah. And I ended it with this. This is not a murder story. It's a survival story. And if you don't hear from me tomorrow, then you'll know it was all true. Lex posted the video on 12 networks. We went dark again. The next morning, an explosion rocked the news. Not from us, but from inside Carver's estate. Someone on the inside had blown up their own evidence room. People were jumping ship. Executives were fleeing. A city commissioner hung himself with a belt made of shredded campaign money. Noah watched it all on a muted TV screen in a corner barbershop. I watched him watching. This boy, this living vault of secrets, was witnessing justice in a way no child ever should. But he was still alive. Because I had refused the order. Because no child's blood was the only thing I wouldn't spill. And now, Miami was bleeding instead. The whole damn city. I always knew it would end this way. With smoke in my lungs, blood on my clothes, and the devil whispering in both ears, asking which way I wanted to die. But I never expected to have a child's hand in mine when it happened. Noah sat across from me in the back of a stolen van, clutching a stuffed rabbit missing one ear, and watching Miami roll past the shattered windows. The news had gone from whispers to sirens now. A fourth banker resigned. A private charter jet exploded on a runway. a judge went missing. They were trying to outrun the piano ledger. The story I leaked, the one they mocked at first. But now the truth had taken on a life of its own, and the people were watching. I had one thing left to do. Carver's estate wasn't just where it started. It was the core. A fortress wrapped in charity banners and historical preservation grants. Where real decisions were made in whisper tones and sealed rooms. I wasn't going there to talk. I was going there to burn it to the goddamn ground. I left Noah with a retired Colombian bodyguard I trusted, Elena. She owed me from Cali in 07. If I don't come back, I told her, run. Leave the continent. He's the only one who matters. She nodded once. No questions. Just a prayer in Spanish I hadn't heard in years. I kissed the top of Noah's head. He didn't speak. He just stared, like he already knew. At midnight, I crossed the causeway into Coral Gables, dressed like the last job I'd ever take. Kevlar under black denim. A duffel bag full of Semtex, Molotovs, and confession letters signed in blood and truth. A burner livestream rig on my chest, feeding a private channel wired to Tomas Delgado, who was hiding in Berlin now. I wanted the world to see. To hear. No more unsettling narratives behind velvet ropes. No more bureaucracy as camouflage. No more shadows of justice. Just truth, and the sound of walls coming down. Carver's estate was quiet, too quiet. The guards were down. The lights were low. I moved like a ghost across the manicured lawn and slipped inside through the library wing. And there he was. Carver. Sitting behind a desk of mahogany and marble, sipping scotch like the world wasn't burning outside. He didn't flinch when I aimed the Glock at his face. Valeria, he said. You're early. I didn't reply. He gestured to the chair opposite him. I'd offer you a drink, but I assume we're past that. You put a child's name in a kill folder, I said. And you killed our business, he replied, still calm. This was never about the boy. It was about controlling the damage. Then consider this the flood, I said. I placed the bomb on the desk, right between us. His eyes finally shifted, just for a second. I smiled. Don't worry. I have one question first. He leaned back. Then ask it. I turned the live stream on, camera blinking red. You're live, I said. Tell them. Tell them why you wanted a child murdered. His jaw twitched. Because he had access. Because his father was weak. Because you weren't supposed to care. I nodded. Thanks. Then I hit send. The feed went live to every journalist, activist, watchdog, and true crime fan I could reach. It was short. Unfiltered. Raw. A chilling narrative in real time. I walked out the front door of the estate, carrying the detonator in one hand. Sirens wailed in the distance. I whispered to no one, no child's blood. Then I pressed the button. The explosion was biblical. Glass, stone, history, all ripped from the ground like paper. Carver died before he could ever stand trial. But the story lived. And this time the people heard it. Later that night, in a burned-out church on the edge of the city, Elena brought Noah to me. He ran into my arms like he still believed I was good. And for the first time in years, I let myself believe it too. I disappeared after that. Some say I went south. Some say I died in the blast. Others swear they saw me in Chile or Barcelona or drinking rum on a boat with a new face and no past. But the truth, you're hearing it now. You're living in the story I refuse to let die in silence. And if they come for me again, I won't run. Because some stories are worth dying for. But this one was worth surviving. They never found a body. No DNA. No dental match. No surveillance. Nothing. Just a crater where Miami's most powerful estate used to stand. A scorched duffel strap buried in the debris. And rumors that the woman responsible had vanished like smoke. But ghosts don't vanish. They hide. They wait. They record everything. I'm not telling you this to confess. I'm telling you this to document. Because one day the headlines will disappear. The hashtags will fade. The true crime genre will move on to the next trending monster. And the story of a boy whose life was almost bought and buried by a contract killer will be reduced to a sentence on a forgotten website. But if you're hearing my voice, then some part of the truth survived. And that's enough. I'm alive. Not in the way you think. I have no name. No fingerprints. No trail. But I exist. Because Noah does. He lives now in a quiet coastal town under a different name. I sent him letters, never signed, always coded. A new one, every year on the anniversary of the day I didn't kill him. He's growing into a man now. Smart. Kind. Free. And the secrets he carries? They're not just about financial corruption anymore. They're about justice. the kind that lives in whispers, scars, and carefully curated silence. Lex disappeared. Delgado lives in exile. Elena took her earnings and runs a shelter for girls in the Caribbean now. We're all ghosts. Hidden killers turned survivors. Some of us paid in blood. Some in time. All of us with guilt. There's a phrase etched into the last page of the piano ledger. One that Luciano Navarro wrote before he died. When the machine no longer hides its blood, only the ghosts will remember. That's what I am now. A memory with a loaded gun and a story to finish. They still hunt me, I think. The ones who survived the blast. The ones who made offshore accounts disappear faster than bodies. But I don't run anymore. I watch. I wait. I document. Because new syndicates will rise. New financial scams will take root in charities and clean energy and education initiatives. And another child will be marked. Another page will be erased. But now there's a precedent. A crack in the armor. A ledger in the cloud. A story that survived their narrative. A blueprint for exposure, hidden in cords and ciphers and a child's memory. They called it a tragedy. They called it terrorism. They called it fake. But now you know the truth. The boy lived. I didn't pull the trigger. And that was the beginning of their end. So if you're listening to this, and you're in a place where things don't add up, where red tape smells like gasoline, where the poor die quietly, and the rich build churches on their graves, start digging. Start recording. And remember, some justice doesn't wear a badge. Some stories weren't meant for courtrooms. And some killers, like me, chose to stop killing. For one child. For one refusal. For the truth. No child's blood. Ever. Again.